Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we present a lecture by University Professor Sir Hans Kornberg, Professor of Biology and Director of the University Professors Program. Sir Hans is actively engaged in research. His main aim is to understand the molecular basis of cellular membrane transport and how this is integrated into the metabolism of the cell. His lecture tonight is entitled, Who's Afraid of Frankenfood? Sir Hans Kornberg.
My title is somewhat obscure, perhaps, to American audiences, but it is familiar to those on the continent, and particularly in Britain. It's taken from Mary Shelley's book published in 1818, in which she recounted the story of a young man who, being ever curious about how things work, accidentally stumbles on the secret of creating life. And he creates a monster that so terrifies him that he abandons him, and the monster then wreaks havoc all around, etc., etc., etc. The British newspapers, particularly the newspapers perhaps of the less intellectual variety, like the Daily Mail and the Sun, to name just two, seized on the analogy of this and the development of procedures to cross species barriers by taking genes from one organism and putting them into another to create crops which were used for food, and they termed this Frankenfood. This, of course, immediately prejudiced everybody against it, and it made me realize that if you want to cure the ills of the world, you should not take two tabloids. Anyway, so that is the story of Frankenfood. Now, having established that there is such a thing as Frankenfood, of course, they then went overboard. Hysteria was caused, a violent reaction. One saw headlines in the papers, for example, Who Plays God in the 21st Century, the genetic structure of living beings is being tampered with. Biotechnology is, of course, exploited for commercial ends and causes hunger rather than alleviates hunger, and so it goes on. In fact, by this time, you should all be rigid, paralyzed with fear as to what is in store for you if genetic engineering is indeed employed. Well, fortunately, sanity prevailed to some extent, and one sat back and said, well, now, what are we actually afraid of? What actually is genetic engineering? And let's just take biology 101 just a little bit, and just let me just remind you, as you said, rather than inform, I remind you, of what is the basis of the genetic code and the genetic message. As you know, ourselves, all living beings, with the honorable exception of retroviruses, which we don't like to talk about in public anyway, sort of things that cause HIV, have as their genetic content DNA. DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid, and it was in 1953 elucidated, the structure was elucidated by Watson and Crick, and I need hardly stress this point. And it was established that it really consisted of two strands which had on them strands of ribose phosphate, ribose phosphate, ribose phosphate, ribose phosphate, had on them bases sticking out. And these bases were such that whenever you had a G in one point, you had an A opposite, and wherever you had a C in one point, you had a G opposite, and wherever you had an A, you had a T opposite, and so it went on. So that whatever was on one strand would necessarily dictate what was on the other. Now, the remarkable thing about this is that, of course, it is a four-symbol code, but of which only three, as it was found, were used. One might say, and in fact, for many years, people did say, how is it possible that something as simple as this could specify all the complexities of living organisms that we see in the world. Well, let me remind you that we are not at all fazed by the fact that there is a two-symbol code, which is a dot and a dash, which is the Morse code. And if you felt like it, although it would be a tedious exercise, you could certainly have the whole of Shakespeare's works or Milton or whatever encoded in the Morse code. So it's not surprising that a three-symbol code, where three out of the four bases are read, are sufficient to specify in mechanical terms all that living organisms are made of. And the code is this. And when I say the code is this, I mean it is a universal code. And where there are small differences, such as, for example, in the structure of the genetic information in the mitochondria, these are just variations, these are just regional accents on the general language. So, for example, if we look at these symbols here, we know that each of them is precise for the insertion of a particular amino acid into the proteins which form our tissues. Now, let me just again remind you that our proteins in all living organisms, consist of roughly 20 different types of amino acids. I'm speaking to you in English, and if I were to write my speech down, and I have not done so, I would be using 26 letters in various combinations. And it is those 26 letters arranged precisely which would enable me to say all I want to say in words, in sentences, in paragraphs, in chapters. And in the same way as there are 26 letters in the alphabet, so there are roughly 20 amino acids in any protein. And the precise arrangements of those amino acids dictate whether it is a skin protein or a liver protein or a kidney protein or whether it is the protein you find in milk or whatever it is enshrined in this. And it is a specific code. For example, if I use the symbol CCC, that is, I have on the strand of the DNA, one C next to another C next to another C, then what is put in place in that growing protein chain is the amino acid proline. If, on the other hand, I have an ACC rather than a CCC, it is another amino acid, threonine, quite different. If I have two A's and a C, it is again an entirely different amino acid, it is asparagine. And if I have three A's, I have lysine, and so it goes on. So I can ring the changes of what amino acid I put where entirely by altering the specificity of the sequence of bases along the DNA. And that indeed, as Charles Darwin would, I'm sure, have wished to know, although he lived 100 years too soon for this, that is the basis of evolution. It is the changes, the mutations, which cause one base to be replaced by another, and if that is of beneficial advantage to the growing cell, that will be a basis for selection of a new strain of living organisms. So that then is the material on which the genetic engineer operates. Why then did it take so long for people to take advantage of this? Well, if we look at ourselves, for example, our cells under a microscope, we have 23 times 2 chromosomes in our cells. Men have 46 identical ones. Women have 46 identical ones. Men have 22 identical ones plus one X and one Y. But there they are. Now, each of those chromosomes is one single strand of DNA, which is enormously long. I mean, the total complement of bases in the human genome is measured in billions. It is 3,000 million bases long, roughly. And therefore, to be able to manipulate this, to be able to seize on one particular bit and say, this is the bit I want to take and translocate, is obviously an insuperable task. There is no way in which this can be done, one thought. But then in the 1970s, a remarkable discovery was made. And that discovery, which was made by three people, alas, two of whom have since died, concerned the recognition that bacteria defend themselves from the attack by virulent organisms, viruses that live on bacteria. You know, we are subject to attack by microorganisms. Microorganisms are also subject to attack by microorganisms. You know, big fleas have little fleas on our backs to bite them. Little fleas have lesser fleas, and so ad infinitum, as the poet puts it, you see. Well, bacteria have the ability to defend themselves against attack by viruses which live on bacteria, so-called bacteriophages, because they recognize that in these enormous strands of DNA, there are specific palindromic sequences. Now, let me remind you that a palindromic sequence is one which reads the same backwards as forwards. You remember probably that the first palindromic sequence which must ever have been uttered in the history of mankind was probably uttered by Adam when he woke in the Garden of Eden and looked at his new companion and then, being a courteous fellow, said, "Madam, I'm Adam." Of course, since he spoke in Aramaic, he would have written it from right to left. But nevertheless, it is a palindromic sequence. Now, you will see that if you look at this bit of DNA, that you have here a palindromic sequence. A palindromic sequence where if I were just to isolate this little bit here and read from left to right, it reads G, G, A, G, C, T, C, C. If, on the other hand, like Madam, I am Adam, I were to read from right to left, it also reads G, G, A, G, C, T, C, C. So this is the mirror image of that. And these are relatively rare along the stretch of DNA. But there are specific enzymes, catalysts, which recognize these palindromic sequences, and they say, aha, they say, wherever I see this kind of sequence, then I am able to split the T from the C, or the T from the C, and separate these strands. So I will separate here the bit from the T and the bit from the C, and pull them apart, and likewise this bit, T, from this bit, C. Now, I can also do this with any other bit of DNA which happens to have the same sequence. So if this is, for example, a sequence from a plant, say a strawberry, then I can separate the DNA from the strawberry. And if this is a sequence from a fish, then I can separate it by in exactly the same way. And since these strands are identical, they are just collections of letters, I can just knit them together. And I can put the bit from the strawberry together with a bit from the fish, and the bit from the fish together with a bit from the strawberry, to reconstitute exactly what is here. C, C, G, A, G, C, T, C, C, A, A, G, C, T, exactly there. And unless you had been following the protocol of the experiment, you wouldn't know that this bit was not identical with that bit. But what you have actually done is you have, of course, crossed species barriers by putting a bit of the DNA from a fish into a strawberry. But all you've done is just knit together these words, these letters. Well, as you can imagine, this was a novel procedure, indeed, when it was first enunciated in the early 1970s. And quite rightly, it caused amongst the scientific community, who were, after all, the only ones who knew what was going on, it caused a remarkable reaction. And it is a unique reaction, and one which I am proud of, and that is that the scientific community unilaterally decided that there were potential hazards in this procedure which needed to be explored before the leave was given to carry on, and they voluntarily agreed to stop all experiments of this type until these safety concerns had been addressed. Now, that, I think, is unique in the history of inquiry, that people actually said, we agree not to do anything more until a committee that we have set up in various countries investigates these possibilities. What happened was that then the government in UK and government in the USA agreed, both with the help of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States and with our own authorities, to set up a working party under Lord Ashby of Brandon, of which I was a member, to set up a working party which would then formulate proposals so that a committee to oversee safety and this practice could be established. And indeed, it's another source of great pride to me that my dear wife sitting over there was a founder member of that committee. In fact, we didn't know each other then, but we met later. So our marriage now is a consequence of genetic engineering, I'm happy to say. Yes. Then many years later, I chaired this group, or its successor, for 9 years. And so far, I'm happy to say, there have been no ill effects reported from the practice of this genetic engineering. So that was the history of how it arose. But, of course, I'm talking here this evening about Frankenfood, that is food. So it's really a rather special case that I have to address. Food, after all, is a unique consumer product. It's unique because, unlike any other, it is one which is absolutely essential to life. There is no way in which we can continue to live without consuming food. And it should therefore be rightly a concern of people that the food should be safe to eat. There's also another matter which I'm sure we will put to the test in about half an hour, and that is that eating is rather a pleasurable activity. In fact, it's the only sensual pleasure which is conducted by consenting adults in public several times a day. And therefore, it is important, again, that I think we should pay attention to what we eat and how we eat it. So why do we want to manipulate food? Well, in the first place, we don't want to manipulate food. We want to manipulate the things that produce the food to a very large extent. For example, it was known, I'm sure to many of you it's known, that in the Soviet Union, for example, more than 30% of all crops grown were destroyed by insects before they were brought to market. So it's obviously important that if we're dealing with a world which is on the edge of starvation, and we are, of course, immeasurably benefited by living in a wealthy and well-fed, in fact, too well-fed a world. The great majority of mankind is not. And even between 6:45 now and 6:45 tomorrow, the population of the world will have gone up by 260,000 people. Just remember that. It is important that we should preserve the food we grow, and if at all possible, increase the amount of food we grow and stop it being damaged by insects or other pests. So the introduction of a herbicide-tolerant or an insect-tolerant gene into a crop confers obvious benefits to the farmer. Also, we know that great areas of the world, like the Sahara, for example, which were once flourishing agricultural lands, are now arid. Parts of the Negev in Israel, I spent a little while in the Arid Zone Research Institute in the Negev, are now totally unable to sustain crops for lack of water and because the soil is too salty. Well, if one can introduce genes from Sparta grass, for example, which can tolerate salt marshes, into wheat or barley and enable now the wheat or barley to tolerate these arid conditions, then, of course, once again, one has made, as Gulliver so rightly recommended, one has made two blades of grass, or in this case, barley or wheat, grow where only one grew before, and thereby has gained immeasurably the thanks of mankind. So those are obvious reasons. We can also manipulate the food directly. Many people in Southeast Asia, for example, particularly small children, suffer from eye diseases which are caused by a lack of vitamin A. This is because they eat polished rice, which contains no vitamin A. It's now possible to manipulate the rice plant so that it will normally make the precursor of vitamin A, and therefore you produce, when you harvest it and process it, you produce what is called golden rice. And the golden rice, to some extent, supplies at least part of the vitamin A that the child needs and stops it developing xerophthalmia, which then causes blindness. So there are obvious reasons why one should wish to manipulate the crops or the food itself. But let's just be clear as to what we mean by genetically modified food. I mean, they're obviously a phrase which encompasses a number of things. There are products which we eat unprocessed. Lettuce containing insect resistance genes. Or a tomato genetically modified so as doesn't go rotten anymore. I remember I was asked once to open the new research laboratories of what is now known as Zeneca, which is in ICI. And for lunch, I was given as a special treat a genetically modified tomato. That is one in which there had been a material introduced which stops the formation of the enzymes that degrade glucuronides, the glucuronides which cause the thing to go pulpy and rotten. Now, this tomato, which was beautiful, firm, and indeed succulent, as I found later, was indeed several months old, and it would never have survived if it had not been genetically modified. These have been introduced into this country also under the extraordinary label of flavor saver. Anyway, you may have come across them. And they can be distinguished from the fact that they don't go rotten and they remain firm and tasty, whereas, of course, the ungenetically modified tomato which you find in the supermarket, it has a thick skin to allow it to be transported. It has other characteristics which have been selected to allow it to be chilled, and it is also totally tasteless. But anyway, there it is. So these are the kind of foods which you can eat knowing that you're also eating altered genetic material. But the great bulk of food that we eat, it does not fall into that category. For example, there are extracted plant products like sugars, oils, lecithins, which have no DNA in them at all, and therefore it doesn't really matter whether they came from a genetically modified plant or not. I mean, the fructose, fruit sugar, it's irrelevant whether it comes, or sucrose, whether it comes from beet or cane. which has been grown normally or which has been modified. It's the same chemically stuff. There are processed foods, like, for example, a tomato puree or soya flour. Now, soya is a plant which you cannot buy without it having been genetically modified. Almost all the soya which is produced in this country is genetically modified. But the soya flour, which we use in such a variety of confectionery and dishes, has all been processed so that the DNA has been destroyed. So there's absolutely no contact with DNA at all. And finally, of course, there are foods whose production involves enzymes from GM sources. Now, vegetarian cheeses, for example, are made with enzymes from bacteria rather than from the stomach of calves, which normally is rennet. Now, vegetarians don't want to eat stuff which has been produced from animals, but they readily accept the stuff which has been produced from genetically modified bacteria. But, of course, the enzymes themselves are free of DNA. So what concerns us is really only the problem of Category 1. That is when we eat the unprocessed food. What then? Why are we concerned about it? Well, people have said, well, what happens to the DNA we eat? And I told this story about my MP interrogator who was concerned about the DNA we eat. Let me just remind you that all of us have eaten DNA all our lives. I mean, we eat meat, which is full of DNA. We eat vegetables, full of DNA. Everything, every plant, every organism that we consume, vegetarian or not, consists of cells, and every cell, except our own human red blood cell, contains DNA. But so far, looking round the room, I don't see any signs of anybody either sprouting leaves or horns or anything else. So clearly the DNA we eat somehow is not incorporated inside us. And indeed, you needn't just take my anecdotal word for it. Some experiments have recently been done. As you see, this is a paper appeared in Nature Biotechnology 2004, which actually put this to the test. And it puts this in test in a rather neat way. These people, Netherwood and Company, have carried out a test using human volunteers who had themselves, for a variety of reasons, had to undergo surgery so as to have an ileostomy, that is a section of the small intestine is removed and the intestine is brought out through the abdominal wall and diverted into a colostomy bag. So they were then given a breakfast of soy burger and milkshake, and both of which contained the herbicide resistance gene. Never mind all this, it's known as Roundup, the agent that inhibits this particular enzyme. And they were asked to swallow this, and then the contents of this ileostomy bag, which had only gone from here to here, was examined. And as you can see, something like more than 96% of the genetic material which they'd eaten had already been destroyed, although it had only gone from here to here. If, on the other hand, they were then tested with intact intestines, it was found that absolutely no of the DNA could be detected. And that was a very sensitive test because this particular enzyme is very easy to assay, and one that can therefore be fairly certain that all the DNA we actually eat is going to be destroyed in the digestive tract. So as far as health hazards are concerned, I don't think we now have evidence there's really nothing to worry about. So what are people concerned about? Well, they're concerned on a variety of ways. Yeah, for example, there is the belief that species are somehow divinely or naturally ordered, and that crossing species barriers is contravening some natural law and is bound to lead to disaster. Well, of course, that implies that what we are doing by crossing species barriers in the way that I've described is indeed something which is novel and doesn't occur in nature. Quite wrong. In fact, the agent for crossing species barriers is a bacterium, which is mostly used. A bacterium which rejoices in the name of Agrobacterium tumefaciens, and which has in it a little piece of DNA, so that the DNA is transmitted to a plant and is incorporated in the plant and then causes what is known as a crown gall. And we've all seen these on oaks and other plants. Now, what all we've done is to say, well, this happens normally. A bacterium will infect a plant, and the bacterial DNA will be incorporated into the plant. And if that happens normally, why don't we take advantage of it? So what we do is we take the little plasmid, the little circle of DNA, which is transmitted, and we snip out a little segment called the T segment, and we put in the bit of DNA that we want to introduce into the plant, and we say to the bacterium, get on with it. And it is the bacterium that does the genetic engineering, not we. It's just that we've snuck it in while it wasn't looking. And it is that technique which has been widely used with tomatoes and with potatoes and with soybeans and with many other types of plants, although it can't deal with all types of plants, but which has been successful in producing so-called transgenic plants. And the technique is one that normally occurs in nature around us all the time. So that particular charge, that we are somehow doing something terribly unnatural, won't stick. Well, what about the next one? The herbicide tolerant plants may contaminate the environment. There would be gene flow. Well, this is true. It may. But so far, although there have been many, many, many tests made, and before any kind of herbicide tolerant gene can be released in the environment, or plant containing it released in the environment, exhaustive tests has to be made, first of all in small greenhouses, then in small plots isolated from anything else, and then in larger plots and so on. And although it is true that some of the pollen from a herbicide tolerant plant can be blown in the wind downwind, so far there's been no serious or even significant problem detected which would outweigh the benefit of this procedure. A herbicide tolerant plant is one which means that all the weeds around it will be killed by one application of the herbicide, and that's it, and the plant will then grow happily. Whereas, of course, if you don't have herbicide tolerant genes present, you may have to apply many, many, many applications of the herbicide. A report which I wrote many years ago, and I've given James Sturgis a copy of it to read, recounts for a fact that the difference in cost of an absolutely blemish-free apple and an apple which has a slight imperfection in it due to attack by some fungus or insect, that this difference in cost in commercial yield is enough to pay for 87 applications of herbicides. And that is why orchards that are not using this technique tend to be sprayed over and over and over again. And with all respect, I think I would be much more afraid of consuming toxic herbicides rather than the gene which I know is going to be digested anyway. Similarly, anxiety has been expressed on on environmental ground that if you introduce an insecticidal gene, that is a gene which stops cotton from being eaten by the boll weevil or potatoes being eaten by fungi, then you may not only kill those insects that attack the plant, but you may also kill beneficial ones. And there was you may remember just a few years ago, there was a great hoo-ha about the monarch butterfly being exterminated by this kind of technique. Well, it was this caused sufficient degree of anxiety that the National Academy of Sciences of the United States set up a group of people to investigate it, and they found that the particular insecticidal gene, which makes a thing called BT, that is the toxic protein from Bacillus thuringiensis, in fact cause no problems at all. The two-year study suggests that the impact of BT corn pollen from current commercial hybrids on monarch butterfly population is negligible. So we have some evidence that this fear is groundless. And, of course, we also know that this material, BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, in dried form, has been sprayed over pine forests and fields for many, many, many years without causing any adverse effects. Indeed, organic farmers who will not accept normal insecticides will accept BT powder and use it preferentially on their organically grown plants. So, again, I think the risks were grossly overestimated and there was no serious adverse effect could be demonstrated. So I've already mentioned transgenic crops. May harm organic farmers? The answer is yes, they may, because the rules which define an organic farmer or an organic product are so stringent that they will not permit the use of transgenic plants. And indeed, we now see, only a couple of weeks ago I saw that there is now a move to persuade the legislature of California to pass legislation which will ban transgenic procedures being used in the wineries of the Napa Valley. So we'll wait and see. But this is a concern which affects the income of the farmer, not the health of the farmer, other than through loss of income. Patenting of seeds by global corporations will harm third world farmers. Absolutely true. And one of the sad things that has happened in the world of genetic modification of food crops is that companies like Monsanto, being one of them, made a terrible mistake initially by producing a herbicide-resistant plant which was resistant to a herbicide which was made only by Monsanto, and putting that into seeds which could be planted only once, so that next year you had to buy the same seeds again from Monsanto. So you really were, to use a phrase which might be more properly used with our troubles with OPEC at the moment, they had you over a barrel. And there had to be very strong pressure brought to bear on Monsanto to alter those procedures. So this is a real concern, but it is a concern which is a political concern. It is a societal concern. It is not a concern which either affects health or the environment itself. Indeed, if we ask, well, how do the third world feel about this? Here is an extract from a report prepared under the auspices of the Royal Society of London, US National Academy of Sciences, and the Academy of Sciences of the less developed world. The Brazilian Academy, the Chinese Academy, the Indian Academy, the Mexican Academy, and the Third World Academy of Sciences. And these unanimously agreed that not only that it's essential that we try this technique, through the use of GM technology, but although obviously and soundly precautions have to be adopted, nevertheless, they were wholly in favor of this line of research being vigorously pursued and the foods then produced thereby being made available to third world countries. So for us to say that the third world doesn't want it, it's just not true. We have to ask them, and they don't. What about the fact that food produced from transgenic crops will be unsafe, for example, allergenic? And here an instance has been cited that a gene has been taken from a peanut and put into another plant, which would still cause an unfavorable reaction to people who are allergic to peanuts. Absolutely true. What, however, is not made clear in the press that reported this is that this was deliberately done to see whether a gene which was useful on its own and a gene which contained also the allergenic protein could be differentiated. And the answer is that the one which also contained the gene for the allergenic protein was transmitted, but the one without it caused no allergies. But that bit wasn't reported. I think it just is another illustration of Chesterton's remark that a half-truth is like a half-brick. It doesn't carry the same weight as a whole one, but it carries a lot further. And this was another example. And so we say, well, why don't we just, if you want to make insect resistance, you could select, after all, you've done this for years, you could select by normal plant breeding. Why go through all this possibly hazardous procedure? Well, let me just give you an instance of what happens when you do it by the normal procedure. If you peel a potato, then the potato skins are associated with two powerful alkaloids. Alkaloids are bases, plant materials, which have powerful biological effects. And these are called solanine and chaconine, and these are inhibitors of cholinesterase. So in other words, they are nerve poisons. Cholinesterase is the sort of enzyme which you try to attack by nerve gases, and these act on the same site. Now, plant breeders, in an effort to produce potatoes resistant to insect pests, have produced tubers that contain so much solanine and chaconine that they now will stop any insect from biting the potato, but unfortunately they now contain so much of these alkaloids, they're also toxic to humans. And of course the trouble is that when you select a genetic product, you select for what you look for, and you don't know what else you're selecting. And it's clear in this case you selected for insect resistance, wonderful, and you didn't notice that you were also selecting for something which would be toxic not only to the insect, but also to you and me. Well, I started off by talking about the transmission of bits of the genetic material from a fish into a strawberry. And this indeed was a point which was pointed to by the Vegetarian Society in raising ethical and moral objections when they say we don't want animal genes in fruit or vegetables. And this also applies, of course, to, say, strict Jews or Muslims who wouldn't want pig genes in their food either. But of course, this assumes that the quality of quote-unquote pig or quality-unquote fish indeed persists in the gene. You can see here is a quotation, for example, now some time ago from the Times of London, where the vegetarian spokesman, rather curiously labelled Miss Fox, said, "What we are concerned about is the use of animal genes. Vegetarians clearly do not want to eat strawberries with fish genes in them." But, if I wanted to, let's say, do a genetic change, where I say I want to transfer, let's say, a fish, cod, and I want to do a transgene experiment where the cod is given resistance to freezing, so it becomes, say, cold, and I introduce an L, then all I do is I introduce an L, and it doesn't really matter whether I take the L from a mullet or whether I take it from a millet. It's the L that matters, and the origin of the L is totally irrelevant. So, again, an understanding of the technique leads us now to overcome this objection as well. So, is then the technique only to be considered potentially harmful? The answer is no. Indeed, a report fairly recently in the New York Times in September starts off by saying Frankenfood comes to the rescue of Mother Earth, and it says, for example, that if properly developed, genetically modified crops may be the best hope the planet has got, because it actually saves expenditure of energy, destruction of soil, and so on in the farming world. Well, what I've said so far is my own interpretation of the science which underlies genetic modification. It's not only my interpretation, because much of this was derived from a report which was produced only recently and which can be downloaded if anybody wants to from the web, which is exhaustive. It's 300 and some pages, and which absolutely clearly and unequivocally states that the scientific evidence suggests that, whereas, of course, we can never say there is no risk, and Professor Barham will no doubt address that point, nevertheless, the risk is so infinitesimal, there's never been any instance reported of harm being done to anybody, or any part of the environment through this procedure, that the benefits far outweigh the risk. And everybody breathed a great sigh of relief that this indeed was the consensus, and one would expect that since in a democracy like the United Kingdom or the United States, people are rational, people would of course accept this. How wrong we were. A wary public says no to GM crops, said in September the London Telegrams. That is, people who had been told about these scientific findings. They said they are still profoundly mistrustful of the government's motives in pushing GM, genetic modifications, on an unwilling public. And it's not only Britain that is being obdurate and Luddite in this. These are Americans who recently appeared in Brussels at the World Trade Conference. Don't force feed us GM, President Bush. And indeed, as I've already mentioned, there is resistance now in California amongst the wine growers, the same thing. And indeed, when I mentioned the need particularly to feed the starving third world, I am dismayed to read in the Times of just the day before yesterday, this article of which this is the first part, that Angola plans to turn away the genetically modified food despite the fact that they actually have undernutrition and indeed starvation in the country. And the same thing applies to Zambia, Zimbabwe, Malawi, and to other countries which escape me at the moment. And here we have people actually starving, and yet, for reasons which are totally irrational, they will not be allowed to be fed. I find that incredible. I find it incredible as a scientist, but I shouldn't have done so, because in a lecture which was given only last month here in Boston, a distinguished professor of law from Dayton, Ohio, stated that biotechnologists, and that even scientists like myself, who are at the not at the sharp end of the application of science, assume that the public would quickly recognize and appreciate biotech's potential for improving the quality of life. Instead, it was the risks that captured the attention of the media. And we scientists assumed that a rational examination of the risks and benefit would lead us to accept that the gains would be to us and not just to the companies that develop GMOs. And that is not so. So one of the talking points that you might like to consider is the much more general question. Not only the validity of what I've been talking about, but also the bigger question. And that is, if the scientists come out and state, this is safe, the general reaction is, I wouldn't believe a word of it. And we have, therefore, to raise the question, why doesn't anybody believe us? And what can we do about it? Thank you.
You've been listening to University Professor Sir Hans Kornberg, Professor of Biology and Director of the University Professors Program. Sir Hans' lecture was entitled, Who's Afraid of Frankenfood? For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Michael Garth and Matt Largy, with help from Boris Strapotsky. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.